Criterion Deep Dives. This is Mike. With me today, I have my good friend, Caitlin Dippo. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, Mike.
How are things?
Things are very good. I'm very excited to talk about this movie with you.
Yes, this here to be mentioned movie. So yeah. Did you searching for the movie, did you have a hard time finding something, or were you immediately I know Criterion Channel, I want to watch this movie?
I knew immediately as soon as you said Criterion Channel what I was going to suggest.
Wow. Okay. So is it something that you're fairly familiar with, or is it you love this particular movie and you know it's a part of the channel?
I do really love this movie. I've seen it 1.5 times. Okay. And the reason I know it's on Criterion is because last spring, when I was doing a Zoom semester of grad school, we tried to watch this movie as a class, via Zoom, via Criterion. And it did not work, which is why we only watched half of it. And so I've been really itching to watch it again.
This was Zoom pandemic class schooling, correct?
Exactly. And someone had a Criterion subscription, so they were watching it on their computer and sharing their screen, and we were watching it through the share screen function. Okay. It was a disaster, obviously. Yeah, it did not work.
That sounds rough. I think it's good. You log onto your own computer, you watch it, you hop on a podcast and discuss it with me. And much better. And then, the class can just listen to the podcast and then, matriculate thoughts from there. So cool. Yes. Well, yes. I think I'm really excited. So I think it's time. What is the movie we're watching?
The movie is Playtime by Jacques Tati.
Okay, Playtime.
Have you heard of it?
I don't think so. I recognize the name, though.
Honestly, there's not a lot of dialogue.
Okay.
At all.
Okay, cool.
So I don't really remember what language it's in, because dialogue is not a really important part.
Okay. Well, I think, I'm excited to watch this. I think we'll get into it more. I'm curious about when you first saw it and the connections between then and the failed Zoom class and your new experience watching it now. So we will be back shortly with our thoughts on Playtime. Back here with Caitlin, having both seen the film Playtime. Caitlin, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing quite well. How are you, Mike?
I'm good. I'm very pleased with the film recommendation. This was a film I had never heard of before, I don't believe, and I enjoyed a lot. And it's a really fascinating film. It's very offbeat, not what you're expecting from just watching a movie. And the typical things about a movie that you expect to see, right? Like characters, plot, story, development. this film has almost none of it.
None of it.
or at least it's twisted in ways that you wouldn't expect. But I love it. I can see why you love it as a student of architecture. And I think that's kind of what I want to talk about first, is just sort of, you mentioned that you... you watched some of this movie recently with an architecture class, but it was a failed Zoom call. And then you said that you had seen the movie before that at some point. So when did you first see this movie? When did you first hear about it? And what was your impression of it when you first saw it?
Okay, so I saw it about probably 2 years ago in Minneapolis at their small independent theater. They just were showing it one night, and I knew of it because in my undergrad architecture class, in one of our classes, we watched another Jacques Tati film, and it was equally as weird. I tried to Google to figure out, he has a lot of films.
Do you remember what name, what it was?
I think it was
Mon Uncle.
I was just gonna say Mon Uncle or something. I think it was that one. Mon Uncle. Yeah, I'm almost positive that it was that one.
That film came up in just some Googling about like architecture and Tati, and there's architecture plays a big role in that film as well, with the building and sort of this idea of modernism and you know, what the spaces that we're interacting with. Okay, so you heard about it in class and then you saw it at the theater. Was this like a was this by any chance like a 70 millimeter screening? Because I learned that he filmed this in 70 millimeter.
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I'm a little bit ashamed to say I don't know, but it might have been.
So 70 sure. millimeter is like the large format prints. You would probably know if it was, because it probably would have been like a really large screen and they probably would have like talked about it. But I thought it was cool that this movie was filmed in 70 millimeter because of the landscapes and the fact that the film is shot from like far away with just lots of characters moving in and out. So you like, if you saw this in a theater in 70 millimeter on a big screen, you like get that detail that you're missing essentially from not having like any close-ups or any medium shots or anything.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, that's very interesting. And it's fun to talk to someone who knows stuff about film about this, I'm realizing.
I know a little bit. I was really fascinated with this movie and with the director and his life and sort of like his approach to everything. He's a very unique artist. You know, I came across him talking about this idea of filming in this way and that he found like close-ups as really crude and vulgar, being that close on someone's face, which I thought was interesting. But I think regardless of that, like, there is a value in just like shooting compositions based on your environment, like putting the camera up to the sky and framing your shot around like the buildings that you're in, or you know, for example, like there's a long protracted sequence in this movie where it's shot from the outside of some apartment buildings and we don't hear what's going on inside, but we see it and it's like a 10-minute sequence and the camera keeps kind of adjusting to the rectangles and the geometry of like the different buildings and the different apartments that we see, because we see inside multiple at the same time, kind of like a doll's house. So what did you think of this movie when you saw it the first time? Like, is this what were you expecting? Was this like totally bonkers to you, or do you know what you're getting in for?
I remembered when I saw Mon Uncle, or however it is properly said,
that sounded pretty good.
In undergrad, Mon Uncle. I was a freshman in college, and then when I saw Playtime, it was probably like 8 years after that. So I remembered that Jacques Tati was like a funny director, and I remembered giggling a lot during Mon Uncle, but I couldn't really remember why. And I feel like that's sort of the delight of his films, is like they're so silly, but the plot is almost not large enough to like help you, or at least help me, remember what actually happens in the film, because so little happens. So like, I, going into the film, I was like, I know I'm going to have fun. I know I will be giggling a lot, but I'm not really sure why. Yeah. And I still feel that way. Like watching this for like the second time, I'm like, why was this so funny? Oh yes.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not like laugh out loud, right? Like
no,
it's like a nuanced humor. It's very physical humor. The closest thing I was thinking of when I was watching this is like Charlie Chaplin films. And and I don't know if you've ever seen like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, those sort of like silent film stars. Later on, looking this up, like those two guys obviously were big idols of his. And he's got Jacques Tati's got an interesting background just in the fact that he was a mime first and foremost. Like that was kind of what his initial profession was.
Interesting.
And then he just got into filmmaking kind of, I think, as an extension of like the theater and that community. But you can see it in this movie for sure. Like there's not a ton of audible dialogue. There is dialogue happening like consistently throughout, but you don't necessarily make out the words. Unless, of course, you're watching with subtitles, you do get some of it. But like, this character that Jacques Tati plays in the film is Monsieur Hulot, and it's a recurring character for him that's also in Mon Oncle and in some of his other films. And I didn't actually realize when watching the film, like, once again, until afterwards, that he was playing a character, playing that character in the film, that the director was. Like, I didn't have the context. I just thought it was some dude.
Yeah, you know, same, actually. It wasn't until last night that I was showing Justin Mon Oncle that he was like, it's the same guy. And we were like, oh my God, is that the director? Is that him? And
yeah.
It was like,
same way of like Charlie Chaplin had a famous character that he played, basically named the Tramp or the Little Tramp, something like that. And it was the same version of all of these things, but like he reappeared in his films, and essentially it's physical comedy, slapstick, falling over, silent films. And when Mon Oncle won for best foreign film in 1958, it was shown that when he was in America for this to accept the award, he just had a request. He's like, I really want to meet Buster Keaton. Like, that's all I want. Like, so clearly these guys were his idols, and there's like a lineage there, but it's really interesting because he's obviously doing something different by like addressing architecture and modernism.
Yeah, totally. I really appreciate the character that architecture plays in his films. And especially the use of glass in playtime.
Yes.
It's like a commentary on modernism, but it's also just like, there are so many ways that he addresses glass, from reflections to like confusion to like no privacy. There's the scene where those men are like carrying the glass.
Yeah. And there's people watching from below, and they're kind of moving a big glass pane,
right?
Which of course, like, that idea of these people carrying a big glass pane is like a constant source of like comedy from, I think, silent films, but just in general, like people walking through it.
Yeah, totally.
On like a movie set or something.
Yes,
like that.
Exactly.
Like, it's a gag that's been done a ton. But I liked in this movie there was more gags with glass, like you said. Like, and I think some of that is also a trick of the camera too. Like, there's a scene where you see someone comes up to this other guy and he's asking for a light for his cigarette, and he tries to give it to him, and then he stopped, and then he like gestures over to his left, and they walk over, and you see that there's a door, and one person was on the inside of the building and one person was on the outside. And obviously that's a trick of the camera, like being contained in the framing of not seeing the sides of the glass. But there's that. There's, of course, this funny thing that keeps happening when some of the tourists are opening the doors, and we get reflections of sort of the old Paris, like the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, that are totally unnatural, right? Like, it's not actually reflecting these things. It's just a weird like mirage that he throws in, which is strange. But of course, it stands out because basically the dominant feature of this film is this really homogenous, drab, modernist architecture from this village that he actually constructed himself.
Oh, okay.
So this whole set was constructed by Tati. After his success of Mon Oncle, he basically was able to convince the studio he's working with to give him 17 million francs and construct the set. And it was filmed out by, you know, this is like the opening scene is at the Orly airport in France. And he basically constructed like a fake airport terminal, these fake buildings, which is wild. And it also like, put him personally massively in debt, which he continued to have to pay off for the rest of his life. So, it's kind of like, I kind of feel guilty watching a movie like this and just like, oh, that was interesting. And it's like, this dude, like, literally his artistic, like, life and that he threw in, like, financially and then struggled to, like, pay back those debts, which is kind of messed up, like, if you're working with a film studio.
Wow, that I did not know that. Yeah, totally. Well, it's interesting. My roommate watched the movie with me for just a little bit, and she like spent quite a bit of time in Paris, and she asked me like, where was this filmed? And I was like, Paris. I have never been to Paris. And she was like, where? Like, those buildings don't exist there. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
I didn't know that.
For sure. And I've been to Paris once. I was there last year, and I actually flew through both airports. So on cab drives and Uber drives, like in and out of the city, there is a little bit more of that sort of mid-century modernism, not the sort of like French architecture you'd expect that you see downtown, you know, in the streets and near like the Eiffel Tower and all that. But it's especially like in stark contrast when you think about Paris, because like Paris is this, you know, beautiful city, and it's not what you'd expect from it. But of course, I think that's part of what he was commenting on, right? Is like the fact that this type of architecture is taking over the entire world. And I think my favorite moment in the entire film is when they're in the travel agency and you see the travel posters in the background, and it's advertising all these areas across the world, like Switzerland, Hawaii. And it just shows the exact same building with then like a lay or like a person skiing in the Swiss Alps. But like, it's really funny. Yeah. And I think like, it, like even kind of aside from architecture, I think it illustrates this point that I was feeling last year after doing a bunch of traveling just throughout the United States to just new cities that I hadn't been to before. And like, I don't know if you've ever felt this, but I got this weird experience of going to new places like Denver and Boston and whatnot, where you kind of have this sense of like, you go to an American city and you want to like experience the things that it's known for, like the food, the culture, the whatever. And I just feel like today it's like, like we have all the same types of things in every city. Like, it's not always the case. Like, I did feel like Portland, Oregon felt like very like unique Portland, Oregon to me, like what I expected. But just sort of this idea of like, yeah, there's a hip coffee shop. Yeah, there's good barbecue. Yeah, there's like, yeah, we have like modern art museums. And I don't know if I'm overlooking like the things that do make the cities unique just as a tourist, but I do feel like when you think about like, I think about like a book that I'm very fond of, On the Road by Jack Kerouac, that is like this idea of these people like wanting to get out and they go and explore and like experience all these things in these new cities. And I feel like this is sort of the same idea, right? Of like removing what makes cities and homes unique.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it comes down to, for me at least, like people. And like, when you go and visit a city, but you never interact with the right people, like that city can feel sterile, and that city can feel like you don't know what to do there, or you're like, feel this like weird pressure to like see the things and do the things, but like
have an experience.
Yeah. But like in reality, some of my most special moments when traveling have been like with my Airbnb host, and like the conversations I've had with them, or like the small meals or moments that we've shared together, where it's like, all these, like what makes a city great is often its people and its, I don't know.
Yeah. And the local knowledge, right? Like the, the stories, the things like that. I mean, obviously like Chelsea and I have traveled places by ourselves that we've had great trips, but I do agree that like when you go on a trip and you stay with like a friend or a host or like someone you feel like you can spend time with and like learn about the place, that you do have a little bit more of a of an insider rewarding experience. And I think that ties into this movie too, like with so once again, like the characters aren't a huge predominant part of the film, but there are some recurring characters, right? So there's Monsieur Hulot, who is the from the other films. And notably, he actually, Jacques Tati wanted to start like moving away from that character. So part of this movie was the idea of like, it's a movie about everyone and he's going to be there, but we're going to like gradually fade him in and out of the background. So we have him. We have, and then we have a large group of American tourists, women in particular. It's like a large group of maybe like middle-aged women. There is the man. There's several people that know Monsieur, but there's the man that he's trying to chase around the building in the beginning sequence. Some sort of like bank or business building. And of course, everything is vague.
Yes, everything is extremely vague.
This whole sequence in the beginning of him trying to have this meeting with this man and it constantly getting spoiled in some way or another. Like, he accidentally ends up in an elevator. He is getting lost walking around a maze of cubicles, all these things. But it's really reminded me of this this film called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeois from this Mexican director, Louis Buñuel. Same time period. He was a surrealist director, and his movies are really cool. But the whole concept behind this movie is that it's this dinner party, and these group of people are never able to sit down for dinner. Like, every time they're about to, there's some interruption. And it's literally like an hour and 45 minutes of like absurdist comedy with them just trying to do this, and it never happens. So, like,
yeah,
it really reminded me of that idea and that sort of like spirit of the film, just sort of like people trying to act in a society and constantly being thwarted, you know?
Yes, totally. Actually, that leads me to one of my questions for you, which is that, like, at what point did you realize that this film was ridiculous? Because I think when you're starting to watch it, you're like with any film, you're like trying to grasp, what is this film about? Like, where are the characters I'm supposed to be watching? And then, like, there are just no hints. It just keeps going and nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And then I feel like at a certain part, it clicks where you're like, oh, nothing's happening. This is just hilarity and like funniness. I don't know. Two great adjectives.
I think that, like, overall I was aware fairly early on, just based on the fact that, like, one, you recommended it and mentioned it had to do with architecture, and two, you mentioned that it was like fairly like there's basically no dialogue in it. So I think I had like a good expectation for like maybe the type of movie that we're in for, like something that feels a little experimental, something that feels different. You're right in the sense of, like, I don't know where it's going to go. It's like, how long are we going to hang around this airport? Or, like, there was definitely a moment where I was like, are we going to watch him like chase this guy around for literally the entire film? And that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But that's one of the first sequences. People walking around this sort of like commercial display area. So there's all these people with these different selling these different products, these really like modern gadgets. Like, there's these doors that when you slam them, they don't make any noise. And they have a motto, slam your doors in golden silence, which I thought was funny. There's a display that has these like Greek Acropolis style pillar trash cans. So it's like a little pillar. It opens from the top, which I thought actually was pretty cool. Like, I wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I thought those were really funny. Yeah, there's the vacuum with the headlights. And
yes.
Or no, sorry, it's not even a vacuum. It's just a broom with headlights.
Oh, I thought it was a vacuum too. It was a broom?
It looks like a vacuum, but
it's got like a big mustache.
Never heard. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't seem like it would function well as either, like vacuum or broom.
Right.
But it did have headlights, so that's good.
Right. So it's just this space like designed to sell things. It's unclear like what people are doing there, where they're coming from. I guess it's close to the airport, so there's that. I think, like, talking about architecture, of course, it's this idea that, like, I think, like, the fundamental idea that I kept thinking about in this film is, like, it really strikes with, like, probably your point of view and with architecture, is, like, you put people in a place and they will just naturally do what the space is telling them to do. So the space is built to sell people things. They are going to, like, suddenly be interested in these things, regardless of what they were there for or what they're doing. Like, it's like a trap of like why people are acting in a certain way. And I kind of felt that
way
for for like all the settings that happen in this movie, you know. The part where they're like kind of zooming around and trying to find each other really reminded me of, like, I don't know if you ever experienced this, but like, you're shopping at the grocery store with like your partner and
oh my god,
you can't find them in the aisles. Like,
yes,
you may be split
and then
off
you
to, like,
do
go...
see them. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you like catch them from the other end and then you like go and then they've disappeared. And it's like, I've done that for like 30 minutes. And it's like,
yes.
Yeah, maybe that's a poorly designed grocery store. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We need to have like mirrors on the ceilings or something so that everyone could see where each other are.
or something. Right, I don't right. know. The other funny thing about that sequence in the office space is like their use of reflections and how Jacques Tati's character is like trying to meet up with this guy and he is actually standing right next to the guy, but all he sees is his reflection like in yeah. the lobby across the way. And so he's yes. like desperately trying to get to the lobby where he thinks this guy is.
There's like mirrors on both sides. So, and I think yeah. that that's another like trick of the camera, right? Like, I don't yeah. think if you were mm-hmm. standing in that situation, it would do that, but it's an illusion of the camera no. that makes yeah. you think that he is really close. And then he's in the other building across the way. I think that's one of those things where it's like in this movie, where you're trying to parse out like, okay, is there like a really serious point about society being made here? Or is like, how seriously is he taking this? Or is it yeah. just like he's having fun with an idea? Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And yeah. I felt like it always stayed pretty lighthearted, but
I would agree. And like, I think that that's part of the joy of it is like, the more times I watch it, the more times I catch on to these little things that are happening in the background. I mean, you were talking about how they never zoom in on anything, but that allows yeah. for like all of these background characters to get involved. And like oftentimes if you're watching those background people, they aren't moving. They're all right. stagnant, like very often. And like, that's funny well, and weird.
Well, interesting you say that. I also learned that to save money on extras, he had a bunch of cardboard cutouts used.
Oh my film. God, that's so funny. Because some of them, so you're not really, crazy. You're like, okay, that's hilarious. Did you notice, I wonder, there's so many things that I feel like I catch on to each time, but like the very first scene even, like there's dialogue happening between this couple that you never see again. So you are like kind of right. paying attention to them. But in the background, uh-huh. there's like actual people in glass boxes, like almost like mannequins, but they're changing positions really slowly. And I think that they're humans. It's moments like those that make me think that he just wants us to be silly and lighthearted, because like, while there might be yeah. some commentary on like modernism and architecture and I don't know what else, but like, it's the little weird moments that are happening in the background or like in the blink of an eye where you're like, you little trickster, what are you
right,
up to?
Right. Well, I will say this, that like, it seems like he has a strong opinion on this idea of modern architecture. Like, okay, if you're going to distill the film yeah. into like a moral or a lesson, like yeah. the lesson that you could say in like three words is like, or four words is like, modern architecture is bad. But then again, like that's sort yeah. of like the lesson that I get from Tati, right? Like, or how he feels. Mm-hmm. However, like, his characters, while they may like struggle to make connections here and there, like they're having fun. Like, they're actually having a great time and they're interacting sure. as human beings in a way that like you can make a much more biting social commentary on like the way that we don't interact in real life with people like nearly as much in today's world, right? So mm-hmm. like, sure, they may be stuck in this like homogenous modern architecture like hellhole, but like they seem to be really enjoying their lives and having a great time. So
yeah.
I do think it yes. begs the question of like, how much concern do we have over this idea of like form follows function while people's lives are in some cases improved by like the efficiency of these things? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think like another funny thing
give me your architecture hot takes.
I don't know, but it's funny that you say efficiencies, because so many things are almost made to be incredibly inefficient yes. in this film, you know.
I think, and I'm like, more extrapolating about like the reality of the world versus the world that's depicted here.
Sure.
Because
sure, yes,
yeah, yeah, because you're right. I mean, there's stuff that is like utterly confusing in places that people have to be, but I noticed in the beginning with the airport, there's just like a ton of signs that are like pointing in directions and where people are supposed to go, but there's almost too many, and it leads to this idea of like things being really confusing.
Yeah.
It makes me think of this like TikTok I saw the other day where someone was in a grocery store, and you know, like how stores in COVID have done the one-way aisles.
And it was like
they were stuck in this area where all the arrows were pointing towards them, like every direction they could possibly go. And they're like, I literally can't move. Like, it's like that Pokemon level that where you're so like, you have the arrows that you move along in the floor, and it's like,
you're just there. You are the destination.
Yeah, yeah. But for sure, it's really interesting. Like, there's definitely inefficiencies. After the whole sequence at the commerce center, whatever you want to call it, I believe the next thing that happens is that night begins to fall, and people are leaving their, you know, offices or whatever, and they're crowding onto the bus. And there's some great shots of the bus, notably one, like, the main gag that happens here is that a man buys a lamp and he takes it on the bus, and several people keep grabbing onto the lamppost as if it's like a pole on the a pole to hold onto on the bus, which is pretty funny. Night falls. Our hero Monsieur Hulot ends up outside of the apartment building, and his old like army buddy or whatever invites him in for a scotch. This is when the scene begins, where we hear no dialogue. We only hear the sound from outside of the street, but the camera shifts over to this panoramic view of inside of the apartments, which of course is notable because the apartment, the residential building, has the exact same design as the commercial building, or at least very similar, right? Like, they're down on the first floor. It's a big open glass window, as if it would be like a display case or a showroom or whatever.
Totally. It's very, very showroomy.
Right. And so the drapes are open. A bunch of stuff happens. Like, people are brought in and out for the next 10 minutes, like in the families. There's a moment after Monsieur Hulot leaves his friend, and we're seeing him and his neighbor, and they're both looking at their TVs in the middle, but we don't see that there's a wall. Mm-hmm. And his friend starts undressing, like, and then it looks like the woman across the way is like perking up and looking at him undressing. So there's this like weird thing at play with the two people interacting without realizing it. And that's kind of that whole sequence. I don't know if I'm missing anything that happens there, but it's definitely like visually interesting.
It's visually interesting, but like it didn't grab my attention as much as some of the other ones. Like, when I think back to this film, I always overlook that scene, and I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just like that the camera is so still, and like we're simply just watching.
Right. And you don't like hear any noise or dialogue or anything.
Right. Exactly. Like, maybe the highlight of that scene is when our main character is trying to leave, and he, like, the light automatically turns off and he can't leave without the automatic button being switched, but he can't find the button and he can't turn the lights on. So he's just like stuck in the dark.
Oh, right. Yes. And and that reminds, like, I've been in situations like that before too, where you have to like press a button to leave or something. You can't find it. One other thing, I think this happens earlier on, but there was something that also felt really reminiscent of my time in Europe last year, where he's trying to, I think he's trying to exit the store, and they're told he's exiting through the wrong turnstile, right? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yes, and it's the pots. He keeps, like, trying to exit through these, like, pot handles.
Yes. Yeah, the pot handles are like kind of jutting out in an arrangement similar to one of those like turnstiles. Which is really funny. But of course, it also reminded me of like this real world experience of being in Europe and the grocery stores, at least like a couple of them where we were in Luxembourg, where my sister lives, and Amsterdam, where you have to like show your receipt. You have to like scan your receipt, and then the little turnstile opens for you. So I guess it's the idea is that it's you can't like leave unless you've actually bought something, so you can't steal something or whatever.
Right.
But we did have an experience where we went into a store to try to find a wine bottle opener, and they didn't have one there, and we didn't get anything. So we were trying to leave, but we didn't have a receipt. And the thing wouldn't open for us. God. And I think we just, like, I don't know, had to, like, jump through some other thing or whatever. But once again, yeah, reminding it's me of so that classic situation. Yeah. So that whole sequence happens at the apartment. The next sequence is, and this is a very long sequence, is at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's like the Grand Palace restaurant or something. And
it's a nightclub, I think, is actually, they call it some sort of nightclub, which is funny.
So I will say that, like, there were some moments that I loved here, and like the concept was funny, right? Like they're in the process of like finishing up this restaurant, nightclub, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not even necessarily open, and then people start flooding in, basically. Which is really funny because they're just kind of not prepared and things aren't going as planned. Yeah. But I do have to say, like, this scene was really rough for me. This was like I liked this movie a lot, but I was like, this is going on way too long. Definitely was just on my phone losing interest. Like,
yeah.
And then I got interested again after this scene, but I don't know if like you felt the same way about the scene. Like, kind of like it didn't have the same like satirical bite.
Well, I think it's okay. Yes, I do partially agree with you because, for one, it's quite long, and another thing is that
it's like at least 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's like the chaos is building and building and building until everything has quite literally fallen apart. Like, the people are stumbling around. The building is quite literally falling apart. Like, no one is like accomplishing anything that they're trying to.
Right.
And I think that as a viewer, it's like you're exhausted because you're just like, it. The other scenes are like calm enough. And
get your
like,
shit together, restaurant.
Yeah, totally. And they keep blaming the architect, which is hilarious. But I also will say that.
Oh, yeah, the architect's like there, I think.
Yeah, for some reason. Yeah. I don't.
Right.
I don't really know why.
Right.
But also, two of my favorite scenes happen in this restaurant, too. So I think, like, as a viewer watching it the second time, I was, like, waiting and waiting for that scene to happen. But then once it happened, I was like, holy shit. Like, this is really going on for a long time.
What are your two favorite sequences from this okay. setting?
My first favorite... No, I'll start with my second favorite.
Oh,
is
okay.
The neon for the big reveal.
Yeah.
The neon sign that leads into the restaurant.
Yes.
They keep trying to kick drunk people out, and then the drunk people see this sign, which is an arrow. It's like on the ceiling, and it's a spiraling. It almost looks like a devil's tail, right, with the arrow at the end. And it's like,
yeah, or like kind of like a question mark.
Yeah,
like,
right. So drunk people are kicked out, and they're stumbling, so their head is like aimed towards the ceiling, and they see the sign, and they follow the sign like a fly back into the building,
right.
And it's just this perpetual cycle of these people not able to leave.
Well, and I think you're right, because I think there's also some people from the outside that basically like zombies walk right into the building.
Yes.
They're walking past it, and then they kind of follow the bright light. And there's also like a lot of like really buzzy sound design used on these neon signs. Like, there's a ton.
Yes.
You can really hear the signs buzz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And now, actually, I think I know what your favorite part is going to be now that I think about it.
Well, maybe. I don't know. It's when the door, the glass door shatters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably everyone's favorite scene, but essentially the doorman, like the glass door shatters, the door that he's in charge of opening and closing.
By way of our hero, Monsieur Hulot.
Yes,
he's trying to open it, and it's locked, and he shatters it.
Yeah. Exactly. So now suddenly the doorman is like, well, actually, I think it's our hero who realizes that if he just stands there with the handle, people will still grab it. And so people start.
Yeah, because the doorman's opening the door for people.
Right.
And so he still has it in his hand.
Right.
Yeah.
And so people keep grabbing for the door handle, even though there's no glass attached to it. And so he continues to be doorman, even though there is no door. And it's just so silly and so brilliant, honestly. It's like, who thinks of these things?
I agree. Those two are great. And I think I think that like there's a lot of stuff I liked, but it just went on for like way too long for me.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
well, and
I'm
it's
like,
also getting to 2 hours in the movie, and you're just like, okay.
Yeah, I think like I was watching the sequence, I was like, okay, this could have been cut in half and the movie could have still been like an hour and a half. Like,
yeah,
right. I don't know. I get it that it's like kind of a stupid thing to complain about, but like, in a movie that is not going to like if you've made it that far, you're not like, you're not necessarily going to be thinking or complaining about like what's happening in this scene. Like, why am I,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you yeah. get the, you get that you're watching something different, but it yeah. did feel yeah. like it was a little long. I did love yeah. this idea of a restaurant that was, literally has not done any marketing. They're just on the brink of opening, but it's this idea that I'm obsessed with just like when it comes to like people's social lives, or like keeping up with the Joneses, and just appearing like our modern equivalent is like posting on Instagram, right? Like, to appear yeah. that you are doing something interesting. But like the fact that this restaurant like gradually fills up to the brim and turns into like a freaking party, after like they weren't even open to start with,
yeah.
and there's just a lot of chaos going on. Like, I thought it was pretty brilliant. I did like that. Yeah. It just took a long time to get there, but
yeah, totally.
I will say that like you've been a server in the past, right? Like a waiter at a restaurant.
Yeah,
I will say that like watching the scene, if you've ever worked in food service, is definitely like gives you a little anxiety. Like,
oh my god, totally.
They're going in and out of the kitchen and like, take this to table, whatever, and it's just like,
yeah,
people are
the
stressed
tables
out.
Are moving.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I also just want to point out one character in this scene, which is the woman who glides. She doesn't even really walk. She just glides, and there's like no mention of it ever again. But there's just one character who out of the blue arrives, and it's like she's on some sort of machine where she doesn't have to walk. She's just gliding around, and it's so silly.
Right, like a Segway or like a modern, like a electric scooter or whatever.
So funny.
Yeah, they keep bringing like fish to people's tables in front and lighting fire and dripping the sauce over, but nobody ever consumes this fish. Like, it's
No.
Yeah.
In fact, the same people are like served the same fish.
Yeah.
Or like different people are served the same fish.
So it's interesting because like you do get the sense of time in this film, that like time is passing as we see it. Like, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of condensed time necessarily. Like, we're kind of seeing it in real time. But clearly it does, because by the end of this sequence at the nightclub, the light is coming back up and it's morning. Right. It's almost morning again. You see this scene of all these cars going in a roundabout and none of them are exiting it. Like, they're all kind of like stuck in this.
Yeah. The carousel.
In this carousel. Yeah. And there's circus music playing. And
This
really reminded me of like the end sequence in 8 1/2, this Fellini movie, which is another director that Tati mentioned by name as like really being he actually was in this speech when he was given this award in, I think, the late 70s, and he gave this speech about the importance of short films and like pleading with this like international organization to help fund short films, because he mentioned Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and Federico Fellini like never would have been able to like get their careers off the ground if it weren't for their short films. So but all of that is to say that clearly he likes those guys. And Fellini was a big fan of the circus and of clowns. And that whole theme came up in his movies a lot. But the carousel, there's like kind of a carousel with all of his friends at the end of 8 1/2, and the music. And similar. It felt really similar there again. So like, definitely of the time period in like Western Europe, when, or you know, in this sort of like elite intellectual world of film in the 60s, like he fits into this world of like Fellini, Buñuel, and some of these like surrealist and experimental directors. So,
well, there is a scene between those two where they go to like the diner or like whatever, that it's like a convenience store almost, and they like are drinking coffee. The main character buys the American woman that scarf. But not a whole lot happens. But that's where the scene where he's trying to leave and he can't leave with the turnstile.
Oh, you're right.
Happens.
You're
right. Yeah.
It all started to blur together at a certain point.
Oh, yes. I understand. I mean, I honestly, I had to watch the movie in two parts yesterday. So I finished it last night. And so it's pretty fresh in my mind. I took some notes. Oh, you mentioned, we didn't really talk about sound, and like, but you mentioned sound a little bit in terms of like the like almost signs. The neon sign, but just like, especially in the beginning, sound is such an important character in this film, and like the shoes tapping on the hard floors and like the weird sounds of people sitting on chairs and like them like shrinking and then like the foam like squeaking together and then, I don't know, retaking its form, popping back to its form.
That's another key point too, is those chairs, because similar to the buildings, the chairs are the same ones used in waiting rooms or like lobbies at the business. They're used at the commercial area. And then the man in his apartment has these same chairs in his apartment. So once again, this idea of like the unitasking or the homogeny of it all, like everything can
mass production of goods.
Everything can be used for every purpose. And the chairs are just gross and black leather. Like they're definitely like a very modern chair, right? Like,
yeah, but they're not, they do not seem comfortable, and like they just seem sticky. It's like that leather that isn't nice to sit on does not like hug your skin. It like repels your skin.
Right. And the back of the chairs also sink down too. Like he's, Hulot's first in the waiting room, he's like playing around with it and he like kind of like karate chops it down the middle. And it just, like I said, I mean, I think when it comes to sound design, like the decision to keep the audience outside of those apartments and essentially operate as a silent film is an interesting decision, and I think a really cool one. I think it was also, I think maybe Buster Keaton who said about Jacques Tati in this film is that like essentially he brought the silent film era back in like a new way, sort of. So I thought it was really cool. Like it's definitely the in a more unique way than that movie, The Artist, that won the Oscar in like 2012, which was just like, we're a silent film, but we're also gonna like be literally like the type of silent film from the 1920s or whatever.
Yeah, so. And it's almost like those sounds became more important than the dialogue itself, you know, or like the dialogue was a distraction from the sounds that you should actually be paying attention to.
Also, like, I will just say that, like, I thought this movie was gorgeous. Obviously, like, the buildings are gross, but like, the way that it's shot, I think from like a composition and like geometric perspective is really beautiful. And like, gosh, I wish I could see this in 70mm, because this is like the perfect.
Yeah.
This is like a perfect use case for like 70mm, especially just the complete total lack of like close-ups. Like, I love to see movies on a big screen that have a lot of landscapes and have like shots that are sort of like. Like this movie is kind of like a Where's Waldo painting a lot of times. Like
it's
shot over from an angle of a lot of people and there's just a lot of stuff going on. You have to pick out.
Oh, that's actually such a good comparison. Yeah.
Well, even with Monsieur Hulot, right? Because you kind of have to find him in the scenes, especially when we switch and we don't know what's happening. So
totally. Or the scenes where like he's mistaken for someone else.
Yes,
or like
yes.
There's actually a few scenes where people are like, aren't you so-and-so, and they're like, no, or like they think that it's him and it's not.
I think he actually like he intentionally put a couple like fake Hulots in there, and once again it seems like he was toying with the idea of this like kind of beloved character that he had created for himself, like of almost doing him dirty, like telling the audience like this guy is a bumbling fool. And not only is he a bumbling fool, but like, I'm not even going to focus this movie on him. Like, this is about something else. So,
yes,
was curious.
That's good.
Like, big picture, like, why do you think personally that this movie is called Playtime?
Wow, good question. Is it because, like, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say maybe this question or this idea is like being too deep about it. Because of course, there's a couple reasons you could think that. Like, it's a silly film, right? It's just the idea is like, it's a silly film. It's got a lot of physical gags. Mm-hmm. It's called Playtime. But like, I was just thinking or wondering what your thoughts were. It's like, is there a deeper meaning here? Is there like a, you know what I mean? Like,
I am notoriously not one to quite grasp the deeper meanings of things. But I will say, like, I wonder if it was just because that's how the film felt to Jacques Tati. Like, this was an opportunity for him to just play. And like, that's how he saw the film as like, this is his playtime. And like, he, like you said, constructed his own environment. He made up all these ridiculous characters and like silliness ensues.
I don't know. That makes a lot of sense. It's like, it's playtime. Like, yeah, for sure. Like,
yeah,
this is like, once again, I don't actually know how he convinced a studio to like, let him make this movie. It was another note, at the time of this movie's filming, it was the biggest, most expensive film ever shot in France. So it was the biggest production in French history.
Oh my god.
But again,
really funny.
Like, again, like, I think with the success of his last film, Mon Oncle, it was like he was given kind of like carte blanche to do what he wanted. So
I really, now I'm wondering why it's called that, Playtime.
I mean, I think we'll stew on that a little bit. Like, my thought was mainly just sort of like, this idea of people, it's like this idea of people like being in situations and, kind of being children and not really know what they're doing. Like, it's playtime in the sense that it's like people are playing with the toys of the world, or I don't know, just sort of like,
yeah. Or like the toys of modernism in a way, like everything, every modern object that is come across or encountered is played with, whether on purpose or not.
I definitely think like the exhibition hall sequence like is this idea of playtime, right? Like people are like fawning over these modern gizmos and gadgets. And some movies, just kind of in no particular order, that came to mind, because there's a lot that I thought of that I think would like interest anyone that liked this movie. I mentioned this director to you, but I think we would be remiss if we did not mention, in a conversation about architecture, the film director, Michelangelo Antonioni, an Italian director who, his films are composed in a way that like has a lot of a, kind of puts a precedence on architecture and the way that they're shot and the way that people interact with buildings. There's a movie he has called Red Desert that I think is like the very like serious, sober, intense version of this movie. It's this woman kind of walking around this like industrial, like hellish landscape in northern Italy and just sort of like feeling lost and depressed. And and it's, you know, shot in this real setting of all these like kind of like scary looking factories. So But his other films too, like he has this movie La Ventura, which is filmed on these like off the Italian coast and these islands. And so there's not really buildings as much in this, but like the way that he shoots the islands and the landscapes feels like, once again, it's like these structures that people are interacting with. You know, I mentioned Charlie Chaplin before, but like the film Modern Times is kind of the most similar to this. Like, in Modern Times, the Charlie Chaplin character is lost in this factory and he keeps interacting with like conveyor belts and different gadgets in these really goofy ways for this same idea, I think, of like people not knowing what the hell was happening in the world, you know? The Marx Brothers Duck Soup, the scene in the restaurant really reminded me of just when too many people are in the same space. And I believe it's Duck Soup when they're on a boat and they end up with like 15 people in the same cabin inside this this boat. So really similar film there. I mentioned Funny. 8 and a Half. Parasite, right? Like, you've seen Parasite, right? Like the house is so central to that story. And
yeah.
Also a set that was constructed just for the sake of the film. Yeah.
And so particular to the storyline.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. There's also this book, High Rise by J.G. Ballard that was made into a movie in 2015 that I saw, which is sort of like this high rise that kind of goes to hell because the buildings are nicer on top, right? Like it's kind of like this idea of that movie Snowpiercer and just sort of like people living up at the top and sort of this like building inequality into architecture, you know?
Yeah, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that because the studio I'm in right now is exactly that in Chicago. We're studying housing inequality in Chicago right now. So that's extremely present on my mind. We're mostly looking at public housing. Okay. And mostly looking at low-income public housing and looking at the policy that is in place that makes for, honestly, like unlivable situations. And like looking at zoning laws, building code, and all of the things that go into making buildings and communities unequal, essentially,
right.
and how it's totally legal and the result of our society or our country's building laws and zoning laws.
You could look at this film and see a certain snobbery too, right? About like the the importance of like architecture, like the Arc de Triomphe and the Eiffel Tower and these things. But like those buildings don't actually serve a like functional purpose for the people that they serve, right? And I actually remember being in Minneapolis with you and you were, we were driving through and there was public housing buildings at, in a certain part of the city that kind of like in a way sort of stuck out like a sore thumb. And you told me about the fact that like, there's a lot of people who were like very anti these buildings because they are kind of ugly, but that actually they served a lot of communities in a way that was like really affordable housing. And obviously they're high rises and like they serve the people that were living in them, right? So do you remember, do you know these buildings
exactly.
I'm talking about? Like,
yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the Ralph Rapson. Oh, it's so sad. It's like I moved out of Minneapolis and I forgot the name of all the buildings. like what is wrong with me?
No, I know. I
Riverside,
remember like
Riverside Terrace.
Okay.
Riverside Plaza.
Right.
Yeah.
But kind of the same thing like I was talking about in this film where it's like the people seem to be enjoying themselves, right? Like
yeah.
and that's why once again it's like Red Desert, that Antonioni film I mentioned, is like super serious. Like this is the fall of humanity. Like this movie doesn't necessarily feel like the fall of humanity, right? But it does feel like we're gonna poke fun at like the world that we've built for ourselves, you know?
Yeah. I think that seems about it. We're going to poke fun at this like ridiculousness that of like something that we have come to put on a pedestal, modern architecture or like modern objects.
Right.
And like, let's just take a moment to look at what we've actually done with that technology.
Right.
And like, also who is it serving and like, who is it protecting? There's like one person of color in the entire film also.
Yeah.
And he is, which I mean, I know it's an older film. It's still jarring to be like, this is an incredibly white film in a very modern.
There's not a lot of like touching on just the idea of like society or politics, like politics in the sense of like architecture and urban planning and like kind of like philosophy of like, how are we living our lives?
Mm-hmm.
But like, you're right. I mean, there's no like poverty present, really. Like,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been engineered out of this little society that they have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. And one just other little connection that I felt, which I think you'd appreciate because I know you love him, is like, not a film, but the Monsieur Hulot character kind of just reminded me of David Byrne, like his. The talking head music videos and sort of like some of his onstage performances, just kind of like the way he moves around and acts, and also just the also just kind of the themes that they touch on their music. I was just kind of reminded of him in a weird way. So
I could see that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I of course do love that reference.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I know you're a big David Byrne fan. So All right. Well, I think, like, do you have any closing thoughts on this film? I really enjoyed it, and I was, like, really glad to open my eyes up to something so different, you know?
Yeah, I very much appreciate the push and opportunity to watch it again, because I had gotten a glimpse of it again last year, but never really got to watch the whole thing. Right. So it was a joy for me.
I actually love the irony of this Zoom call of you guys trying to watch this film together, because it feels like an extension of the film itself.
Oh my God, you're so right. Yeah.
Like the architecture of, like, online communities failing at, like, bringing people together for this shared experience. So
totally. And there were so many silly blips that were happening too, that it did. It felt like a gag. And of course I was at my parents' house, where they have, like, dial up internet. So there was also, like, this whole, like, huge buildup to me and my family, because I was in Michigan, and we were like, are we even going to be able to watch it? And then it wasn't even our internet that went bad. It was like someone else's.
I think there's a lot in I think there's a lot in our modern world, especially the year that we're living in, with kind of living virtually and for very good public health reasons. But I do think it takes someone very sophisticated and clever to kind of pull off what he did in this film in a way that doesn't feel cheapened, because there's a lot of, like, easy ways to poke fun at our modern world, but I think it's really hard to do it in, like, a really natural, nuanced way that isn't like a lot of dumb memes and videos you see online, you know, which is
kind
of the content that rules the day, you know?
Yeah, no, that's so true. And, like, still things that hold up, I think, that are, like, still funny and still silly and not overplayed and very clever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again, Caitlin, for picking this film and for joining me on the podcast. And
truly, thank you.
Yeah, for sure. I think we look forward to watching more of Jacques Tati's filmography and and seeing what else he has in store for us. So, thanks again, and we will talk soon.
Yes, thank you.